Welcome to Fireside Markets, your audio home for thoughtful and insightful discussions of financial markets, investment strategies, economics, retirement, and more. Fireside Markets is hosted by James Osborne, president of Basin Asset Management, a Colorado registered investment advisor.
Hi, this is James Osborne, and you're listening to Fireside Markets. Today on the show with us, I have Patrick O'Shaughnessy. Patrick is a principal and portfolio manager at O'Shaughnessy Asset Management. He is also the author of Millennial Money, a book recently released targeting his and my generation and their finances. And more recently, the writer behind the blog Investor Field Guide. We're going to talk about a lot of things today. Patrick, welcome to Fireside Markets.
It's great to be here, James. Thanks for having me.
So I want to talk, we're going to cover a lot of ground today and a bit widespread ground, but let's start with your background. You were a philosophy major at Notre Dame, and I won't hold going to Notre Dame against you. Talk about, if you can, why you chose philosophy and what you thought at the time you might do with that.
Sure. So maybe not the answer most people expect, but primarily I chose philosophy because I really hated school and I wanted to find something that had a lot fewer tests than most typical classes do. And philosophy, if for anyone that's taken those classes in college, is typically you meet a few times a week and gaze at your navel, and then you submit two papers or so per semester, and that's the majority of your grade. And I've always liked to write and kind of pontificate. And so I thought that it would be a natural match, and it developed into a real passion. And what I got out of philosophy, I think, was a system of thinking, a way to think, a fairly skeptical mindset, argumentative maybe even. But I really enjoyed the philosophy program because of all of the ideas that you're exposed to. So maybe I got into it for the wrong reason, being a little bit lazy in school and really not liking school, not liking being taught to, honestly. I know people learn a lot of different ways. I learned by reading, not so much by being in a lecture hall.
Yeah.
And so that was the original motivation that turned into a really deep passion.
I think a lot of people would take issue with calling the study of philosophy lazy. But whatever works for you.
It's a mindset though, James. It's for some people, it's a love-hate thing. Most people I knew despised their philosophy classes, and it was like the biggest weight on their shoulders as part of the core curriculum. And I think for other people, it's just different. I couldn't get through an engineering class. I'd have as much difficulty there as a lot of people do with philosophy. So it depends on the person.
Were you concerned at all at the time or approaching graduation what you were going to do with that?
Yeah, very concerned. I mean, I think most philosophy majors don't know what they're going to do. Maybe the easiest solution is to go right back into grad school.
Right.
I knew a lot of my classmates who were philosophy majors that became lawyers, that went to law school, things like that. I had no idea.
Did you consider that? Because when you said skeptical and maybe argumentative, that was my immediate thought, was law.
Yeah, my family used to, when I was a little kid, used to call me contentious man. And I always thought that I would be a lawyer. And I think I probably would have enjoyed law, but ultimately that wasn't the way I went.
So you ended up in finance. What did that look like?
So again, kind of some blind luck here. So I graduated in the summer of 2007. It just so happens that my father was in the process of forming a new asset management company and offered me an unpaid internship to basically come on and see how a business is born, help set up some of the really tiny details and just kind of watch what happens in the early stages of a business. And I didn't necessarily think I'd love the world of finance, but I thought it'd be pretty dumb to pass up that opportunity. So that's really simply how I got started, just kind of a stroke of luck. And turned out to be kind of weird market timing, because just a few months later was November 07, which turned out to be the market peak. And then my early years were pretty traumatic in the business. But looking back on that, I think it's probably a good thing. You learn a lot of lessons in those tough markets, and yeah. I'd rather have that early in my career than late.
Yeah, that's the truth. And as a saver, I'm sure you feel the same way, but might be a separate conversation. Yep. So when you were interning, did you find yourself more attracted to the business aspect of getting the startup off the ground or the finance investment stuff?
So I realized probably within 3 weeks that it was the research and investing and market side that was really interesting to me. And the reason was that part of philosophy is psychology and just trying to understand how people think. And what fascinated me was market psychology, that it seemed in the first few books that I was reading that essentially this is the perfect grand scale psychology experiment with a scoreboard. And you can study behavior patterns in very interesting ways. And so the investor behavior part of it was what really got me hooked. And then the research is what I've done ever since, which is trying to find ways to exploit, you know, common behavioral mistakes that investors make. And so it was pretty clear from early on that the research side is where I would focus. I'm fascinated by the asset management business itself, but most of my time is spent on research.
You didn't go from interning at OSAM to working there. There was an in-between step. Talk about that.
Actually, there wasn't a step. So I went straight from being an unpaid intern to being a, I don't remember what we called it at the time, a research analyst, whatever the entry-level analyst position is on the research and portfolio management team. So once we figured out that that was the direction that I was interested in, we jumped right into it.
And you've stayed there since?
Yep.
Oh, I'm misremembering something then. Talk to me about what it's like working at the company that has your name on it.
You know, it's pretty easy. I mean, if anything, I'm just incredibly lucky because I've been able to do things at a younger age than I would have been able to do at a traditional asset management company. You know, access to research, decisions on research. Certainly in the client facing side, I got started, you know, giving presentations and speeches and things like that at a very young age, probably when I was 23. And I just don't think that would happen elsewhere. So if anything, it's just an incredibly lucky position that I've always found myself in from a career standpoint. Sometimes people ask me, you know, is it awkward? Is it weird? Are expectations high? Those sorts of things. I don't really think about any of that stuff. I just think, you know, I'm very lucky to have been able to start so much younger.
Yeah, good for you. Your father is a legend in circles. What Works on Wall Street is sort of one of those books that everybody has read. I actually laughed. We were in a used bookstore in the mountains a couple weeks ago, and I picked up a first edition of What Works on Wall Street in this used bookstore and flipped it open. And, you know, it's dedicated to you and your siblings, which I got a kick out of. Did you know growing up finance? Was it part of the household, or was it just what your dad did for work?
I mean, I knew it. And as soon as I could, I read his books and obviously wanted to understand at some level what he did, but it certainly wasn't a every day or every week or every month conversation. You know, his teaching towards me and my two sisters was really never prescriptive. It was never, you know, believe this or believe that. The main lesson he taught me started at a very early age. And basically what he said to me is, if you want something, come up to me with a cogent argument for it and I'll give it to you. You know, I was probably 5 years old when he first did that, and he probably did use that word cogent.
Right.
If I asked what that means, he'd say, go to the dictionary and figure it out. Look it up. And that was sort of my lesson as a kid was look it up. And that certainly has formed a lot of who I am. So I grew up around it to some extent, but his method as a parent, which I, looking back, you know, I'm going to certainly try to replicate it with my own kids, is not so much to teach us what to believe, but how to think and how to investigate.
Hmm. Talk about your day-to-day at OSAM. What you do research, what does that look like?
So my day is really four things. It's reading, it's writing, a huge chunk of it is programming, coding, and talking as well. And so the structure of my day looks pretty similar almost every day. The first thing I do actually is try to write down five different ideas. Someone suggested this to me a few years ago, and I can't remember who it was, but I found it to be an incredibly useful exercise in the morning to just try to, they can be really small, they can be research related, they can be really about anything. But just to kind of warm my mind up is to write down five ideas. I use Evernote as sort of my repository for everything, for collecting ideas. So I start the day with that. And then a typical day is mostly research. And that's done in this kind of massive sandbox that we've built at OSAM, which takes data in from a whole bunch of different places and sort of organizes it, scrubs it, ties everything back to single securities. And then the research team is able to do research on top of that in that big sandbox. And to do so, it's mostly programming, which, you know, again, looking forward 9 years when I was in college, if you told me that I would be spending the majority of my day programming, I'd say you're definitely wrong on that. but it is a means to an end, which is, you know, we're able to, because of the the engine that the firm's technology people who are just incredible have built allow us to answer market questions or test market hypotheses very, very quickly. So it's a luxury, honestly. It's really just interacting with market data, testing out ideas and trying to understand markets from that perspective. That's most of the day is that research component. I do a lot of reading. So whether that's academic papers, books on investing, really anything we can get our hands on, sometimes even some sell side research for fun, although we don't rely on any of that for our process. And then I write, as you know, I've written a book. I do a lot of writing for the firm, sort of market commentaries, talking about factor investing, quantitative investing. And then talk, I mentioned the last thing I do is talk, which is fun because I speak to a lot of prospects, to existing clients, talking about our strategies, about performance. I love to speak in public. And so I do a decent amount of speaking at, you know, industry conferences and things like that. And then a little bit of media here and there. So that's pretty much my typical day, mostly research, but all reading, writing, coding, and talking.
So when you're doing research, what is it that you're looking for most of the time? Or what question are you trying to answer?
Well, the question we're trying to answer is, are there common characteristics shared by stocks that the market misprices? So we know that certain categories of stocks have performed very well historically. Value stocks is maybe the most obvious and prevalent example.
Right.
We're trying to find one, what's the best way of measuring those things? So you say value, that could mean a lot of different things. How do you measure value? So one element is, how do you measure these key concepts? The second is looking for new concepts, whether it be, some other famous ones are momentum, or more recently, quality has become really popular. Looking at a company's balance sheet, looking at what it's doing with its capital. Capital allocation, I think, is an area that we have a lot of expertise in that doesn't get enough attention. But capital allocation, what companies are doing with their money or how they're raising new funds, is really important. And there's been a lot of implications for the results, the forward results delivered by those stock prices based on different capital allocation methods.
Have you read Outsiders?
I have, yeah. So great book, really good book. A much better written book than maybe we would write on the topic. But basically what we're doing is taking everything he talks about. I think Thorndike is the author. Mm-hmm. What William Thorndike is talking about in Outsiders and making them empirical tests, saying, okay, well, the guy at Teledyne did this. He did a lot of share buybacks, things like that. Let's test to see if, as a category, companies that buy back higher percentage of their shares outperform the market. And it turns out that they do. So just trying to systematically evaluate stock selection strategies, and then also, of course, try to make sure we're not just data mining, because if we test 1,000 things, just by pure chance, there's going to be some that work. So trying to tie these ideas back to what we started talking about, which is common, repeatable, consistent behavioral mistakes that investors make as a group.
So if you find something, you'd like that to validate a story. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, we want to be able to say, for example, with value, there's all sorts of interesting behavioral research. The one I like the best is that we know we're about twice as sensitive to negative events as we are to positive events. We've got this sort of loss aversion or negativity aversion. And that's basically what value is, right? Value is a nice word. It sounds good, like you're getting something.
Everybody wants that.
Right. But what value really is the more value means the lower the expectations are collectively for that stock. And what the behavioral research tells you is that people tend to overdo it at extremes when making forecasts about the future. So they're overly pessimistic for value stocks or cheap stocks, and they're overly optimistic for very expensive or growth stocks. And they're that way quite consistently. So you can do very well in the market by being long the very cheap stuff, or the stuff for which the market has set very low expectations. And maybe even if you want to be long short the growth stuff, or just short the market. But we're looking for common things like that, where the market gets it a little bit wrong and gets it wrong consistently because of investor psychology.
It seems from where I'm sitting that there's been a small explosion of these types of strategies in the last maybe 5 years, in sort of a quantitative data-driven approach to maybe it's value investing or some type of factor investing. And you see this in the rise of smart beta ETFs and fundamental indexation and the explosion of popularity of dimensional funds, which is, you know, also a factor-based system. Do you worry about a crowded field or diminished value in that space?
Yeah, I'm like you, fascinated with this trend of really the two prevailing trends that we see are assets going into index funds, going passive, and a second kind of major trend, I think it's like $500 billion now, is this whole smart beta thing. Mm-hmm. And the funny thing about smart beta is that it's just a new name for something that's been around a long time. DFA were pioneers of this investing style, which is to tilt an overall market pretty much towards smaller stocks and towards value stocks. Now, there's a million different ways of doing this. But essentially, if you buy a fundamental index, for example, which is probably the biggest asset category in the smart beta space, effectively what you're saying is, I believe in smaller stocks and I believe in cheaper stocks.
Right. You can't move away from, or basically anytime you move away from the market cap weighted index, you have to move smaller and towards value, essentially.
Not necessarily. You could build a portfolio that's a lot more expensive than the S&P 500. But if you're going to do it based on fundamentals, if cash flows and earnings and dividends and book value become a part of the equation, then yes, just you're always going to be tilting more towards value. I think that the fundamental index idea is just not all that new. It's just a brilliant way of spinning an older strategy. It's kind of have your cake and eat it too, and it's a brilliant alignment of incentives from asset manager to advisor or intermediary, whoever that is, to the end constituent or investor. You know, you're never going to underperform by a crazy amount, or at least you shouldn't. It would take a pretty weird environment for that to happen. So the career risk is mitigated, and of course, it's a small bet. Yeah, of course I'm concerned. Yeah, so you're saying you like small and value, but you just like them a little bit. And our contention has always been that value, true value investing, should hurt. That value works because it forces you to buy assets which are very uncomfortable. Think about buying in perpetuity, whatever it happens to be that year. But let's say last year in the fourth quarter, it's buying into the big integrated companies, integrated oil and gas companies around the world. That was a trade that hurt. And it's because the outlook was so pessimistic from the market and prices got so low. Imagine doing that every quarter for the next 20 years. I mean, it is a very difficult strategy to stick with. It's why I always say that, you know, everyone seems to be wanting the small value tilt, and there's so much data out there now. Anyone can run a screen. I think that the best way to evaluate a strategy is not to ask how easy it would it be to replicate this strategy, but instead to ask how hard would it be to stick with this strategy.
Yeah.
I think things that require more intestinal fortitude and discipline will probably retain their edge longer. So I'm a little bit worried about, you know, factors becoming so in vogue and so popular. And, you know, there's ways of measuring how popular value is. Look at the spread between, you know, the cheapest 10% of stocks and the rest of the market. And that's that spread, which you ideally want to be really wide. It's not at all-time lows, but it's certainly in the low end of the range, meaning that valuations are all looking more similar to one another than they have been in the past. But that even that idea of spreads hasn't been like a useful timing indicator.
Right.
In hindsight, it looks like it might be because the spread blows out at crazy extremes like 2009, 2000, 1990, 1982, 75, 70, you know, during times of market duress. But you can't identify those peak points in real time.
It's like trying to use valuation as a market timing strategy. You can't do it.
Yeah. Yeah, it just doesn't work. If you pick your inflection point perfectly, then fantastic. But, you know, these things can move very aggressively and quickly and then reverse very aggressively and quickly. So, you know, we don't advocate using spreads as a timing tool or anything like that. But maybe it's some general indicator of how popular value is, and what the reading it's showing today is that it's pretty popular.
Is it possible that trend is permanent? I mean, I have two thoughts. One is, what if people can stomach the trade because they don't know what trade they're making because it's wrapped inside a fund or ETF? You know, if all you have to trade is the ETF and you don't actually know what it's holding, maybe it's easier to buy the big integrated oil and gas companies. Or if it's a global value strategy, maybe it's easier to buy Greece and Russia if you're just buying the value ticker. So I guess that's part one. And then part two of the question is, with an abundance of data and information, is it theoretically possible that what we might call the value premium could shrink, maybe permanently?
I certainly think that the value premium could shrink. But again, like a lot of this comes back to how you define things. So is the value premium, you know, the cheapest quintile of stocks by value versus the market, or is it something more concentrated? We tend to be a lot more concentrated than your normal quantitative manager like a DFA, a lot more concentrated, because we believe that, and our process, you know, I can't go through it all, but our process isn't just about value. It's a number of different things rolled together, which I think allows us to get a little bit more concentrated. But the key thing that we've noticed is as soon as there is a period of bad performance, then that lack of transparency can go away pretty quick, especially in a more concentrated portfolio. So if you say, okay, I like value, I buy value, and then a year later it's underperforming by 15% versus the S&P 500, which is certainly possible, it happens. Then all of a sudden, if you go in and see what names you own, value makes it so much harder because the names are all dogs.
Right. At least if you're
in a growth strategy. Right. At least if you're underperforming in a growth strategy, you can say, well, you know, it's doing badly, but it's these great companies that have this parabolic growth and exciting stories, and, you know, they'll rebound. With value, it's just like pure despair. They're getting beat up and the prospects look terrible. So it becomes very hard to stick with under times of extreme underperformance, and those will always come. So you know how people are with performance. Typically, they're going to sell after a bad period and buy after a good period, which doesn't work out in their favor. But they'll do the same with value. Value will go through some protracted period of bad performance, and people will move out in droves at just the wrong time. And then the disciplined value investors will benefit ultimately. So yeah, maybe you're not going to see some of the crazy numbers you might have seen, you know, a couple decades ago from a systematic value strategy. But I do think because of the kind of behavioral underpinnings of why it works, that there will always be some advantage for people that are willing to stick through, maybe even and even more of an advantage for more concentrated portfolios, able to stick through the tough times.
Do you think? You talked about this a little bit in your book. In your book, you kind of give an overview of what it means to be a value investor when you're talking about, and it's, you know, this is introductory investing type of stuff. Do you think you can teach people to be good value investors? Can you teach people to behave? Is that possible?
It's a really good question. I think there's no doubt certain investors and people have a better disposition for certain kinds of investing. I know some guys who have been really successful as deep value investors. I know others who are great practitioners of trend following and momentum. And I think the disposition required for both is very, very different. The value one is very stubborn and contrarian and patient. And that's not what defines a momentum investor. So I think no doubt some people are just born with the disposition for certain kinds of investing success. And I think some chunk of people can't be taught. It's really why my baseline investing advice, if I don't know somebody, is just to buy index funds and pair it with automation and disinterest. You know, I think that for most people, that without knowing anything about them, that's probably the most prudent investing approach. It's obviously not how I invest. I think that investors can do better. But I do think it's a good baseline because for most people, it's just hard. Like, for example, I was at my in-law's extended family barbecue this past weekend. And as you might suspect, you know, I always field the questions about investments because I'm in the world and people ask what I think about X, Y, and Z. And
you think of the market right now, Patrick.
Yeah. What's hot? What should I buy? What's the tip, et cetera? And, you know, you and I and everyone that else has been on your podcast, we all live in this world. So it's almost, I read some of these behavioral studies, I'm like, these people can't really exist. There can't really be people making these mistakes.
But and then you everywhere. Go to the barbecue.
Then you go to the barbecue and it's, you know, well, I'm up 16% so far this year. So now I've got a halo effect that I'm, you know, I've got the golden touch right now. And so I'm going to suggest to all the other relatives that they got to buy UTX. And there's this biotech, these are the exact examples. There's this biotech fund that's on fire. You got to get some of that. You know, just very haphazard and crazy. And, you know, I guess in a perfect world, I would try to dissuade people of these decisions. But I just didn't have the energy, honestly. Like, I feel like I might have stopped one stupid decision, but then, you know, they would have just gone back to their ways in a few months. So I just think, unfortunately, there's some subset of people that just aren't going to be good investors no matter what we do.
What responsibility do you feel you have for your investors' returns? I mean, do you worry about the year when value underperforms by 1,500 basis points and investors are ready to blow out? You know that, you know, you have a deep conviction that value is going to outperform in the future, and these periods of underperformance are part of that cycle. Talk to me about what you feel is your responsibility for investor returns, because everyone knows that by and large, investors underperform their own investments, their own strategies.
Yeah.
Do you, as an asset manager, do you have a responsibility to try to narrow that gap?
So we do. And I think that the best way to do it for a firm like ours, so we run higher tracking error strategies than is typical of a quantitative manager. With higher tracking error, I think comes, I don't have the exact data to prove this, but my guess is this is right, that higher tracking error strategies give investors more opportunity to make bad timing decisions.
Sure. Even just more volatility is going to give people
right
that chance.
So, you know, I definitely believe that you want to be able to invest in something you can stick with above something that just does the absolute best from a performance standpoint. And we try to balance that, but we also really do believe, based on a lot of research and a lot of real-time results, that, you know, having a little bit higher active share, higher tracking, or however you want to quantify it, portfolio versus the market, is probably the best way to do active management, because, you know, there are higher costs, and costs are really important. You know, I always love that Bogle phrase, the tyranny of compounding costs. And you have to be cognizant of those. And we believe that to earn out those costs, to clear that hurdle that those higher costs create, that a more differentiated portfolio increases those odds. Now, it increases the odds on both ends. Right. Active share is so popular, but it's not some panacea. All wow. active share means is, you know, high active share, you have the chance of doing much better or much worse.
Right. It just increases the dispersion of possible outcomes.
That's right. So active share in and of itself is not, I mean, I guess it's important, but it's not some cure-all. What we think matters is a little bit different strategy, a higher active share strategy tied to something that's very disciplined and proven. Now, along with that, I think comes an obligation to really educate investors as much as they'll take it. We do a lot of writing. We are very transparent about our process with our investors. I think that, you know, big investors really understand what we do and know what to expect, and know that we have a long track record of delivering on what we say we're going to do and not deviating during tough times. So I think a lot of it comes back to, we believe this is better, but it requires a lot of education and clear communication constantly. That's not just in the sales process, but throughout the investing process with each quarterly call, really whenever we can communicate or write papers, anything we can do. We do our best to fulfill that obligation by being consistent and clear communicators.
Have you ever thought about gatekeeping, or do you ever practice gatekeeping in an effort to try to make sure that you're getting investors who are going to participate in those returns, or is that a little too paternalistic for you?
I don't have some philosophical problem with it. We don't do it. We have no intention of doing it. I think an advantage of, you know, a lot of our assets are in large cap, you know, but in most equities, a pretty liquid portfolio is a nice thing for most of our investors.
Sure.
So we haven't done it. I'm not against it. I'm not particularly for it. It's just not something that's part of our process.
So you talk a lot about communication and speaking and writing. And it was either earlier this year or late last year, you started Investor Field Guide. Talk about Investor Field Guide. What do you want to accomplish with the new blog?
Yeah, so it's really, I'm always very wary of goals. I'm not a goal person. I think that you should build a really good process and stick with that, and that process will produce good things. And so in this case, it's really just all about shared discovery. I found that as a researcher, it's much better to learn with an audience than to do it in isolation, because what I've found is readers of the site are just really interesting and bright people that often solve problems that I've been struggling with very quickly, or just have great suggestions for a new angle of something that I've been looking into. So it's really just about shared discovery, about trying to learn, collect information, and then the writing is just trying to collect that information into a coherent narrative. And that's really all it's about. I think it will ultimately become a book of some sort. I almost pitch it as like a book in beta form. And I've got a whole lot of feedback mechanisms built into the website. So there's, you know, a way to rate each post, and I track that very closely. And I follow what's popular, what resonates, what doesn't. So it's almost like writing a book lifetime. And obviously the book would ultimately have a lot more information and be much better written, and there'd be more structure and whatever. But it's been a great way to sort of test out ideas and get very quick and instant feedback. My sister, my young sister, she's just 20 years old, really impressive girl, is into comedy. And she's just been doing the stand-up comedy thing in Manhattan, which obviously is a tough place to do it. And it's like a less extreme version of that she gets to constantly try stuff out and tweak and adjust and improve. There's this like incredibly quick feedback loop.
Right.
And I just love that idea. And so the site is just trying to get interesting people thinking about interesting ideas together. And hopefully someday it will be a book, and hopefully it helps people make the decision about active management as well. I think that's maybe if there is a goal, I think that might be one of them. That's the big raging debate today. Should we just forget about all this and go golf and just index our money? Or should we try to do a little bit more? And I hope to help some investors answer that question for themselves with a lot of the data and the research that I present.
One of the most popular pieces, from what I can see, on the site is the book club, the book list. And really anytime that you end up talking about books, you did a bulletproof book recommendations piece that was great. You read a lot. Do you think that's a direct result of your philosophy background?
Maybe it's one of those things where it's just what I love to do. And I didn't really figure that out until after school, actually. And maybe it's just because I got to read whatever I wanted and not what was prescribed to me. I hate that. I hate being assigned things to read. So I really began reading like a lunatic after college. And in the first couple of years, I probably read 150 books or so a year. And I probably read about 100 books a year now. And because I read so much and I'm always talking about books and asking people about books, people would always come to me and say, well, what do you got for me? What's a good recent book? And instead of having to have that conversation a million times, I thought, well, I'll just start up a monthly list and send out, you know, 3, 4, 5 books that I've really loved, some all-time favorites or some recent favorites, with a little write-up on each book or whatever. And people can sign up for that if they want. And so I stole the idea from this guy named Ryan Holiday, who's written, I think, 3 books himself. So I think he's on the marketing side of things. So a different background, but a voracious reader, a really great reader. And a lot of his book recommendations in his monthly email led to great finds for me. So I basically replicated what he does. So thanks to him. And what I've been doing for, I guess, 18 months now is every month sending out 4 books, and it started very small and it's gotten nice and big. There's probably 5,000 or so people on the list today.
Wow.
And the best part about it, honestly, is originally it was for me to give suggestions, but now I get a lot more suggestions than I give. So when you sign up for the book club, the first thing you get is this long list of a bunch of suggestions just to get started. But I also ask in an email, you know, can you send me your favorite book? Because I'm just always trying to find something. And so I get just a crazy amount of suggestions, great suggestions, and have found a lot of my recent favorite books because of feedback from people on that list. So it started just very small, and it's become really, really fun. I look forward to writing that every month, and I've gotten to know some people because of it. It's just a really great way to share books with a whole bunch of people.
There doesn't necessarily seem to be a narrow scope of what you'll read or what you have read. I mean, I've seen everything imaginable. Obviously, a lot of it is nonfiction. Will you just pick something up because it sounds interesting? Is there a system? Is there a methodology? Are you trying to Do you bounce from subject to subject, which is what I find myself doing when I read nonfiction? What are you reading right now? What's next? And how did you decide on that, maybe?
So I probably read mostly in a couple broad categories. So it probably looks like my reading library is crazier than it actually is. Those categories broadly are investing, certainly, although it's rare to find a good new investing book. History, philosophy, specifically Eastern philosophy. Mythology, strangely, is one of my, it's probably after investing the topic on which I've read the most. And then I love poetry and I love really good novels. So something within those categories will usually be suggested to me, or I'll use like the Amazon feature, for example. If I like one book, you know, that customer's also bought this.
Sure.
There's all, you know, Goodreads. I use pretty much every service that's available, I use in some way. Goodreads is probably the one I use the most often. And followed by suggestions from people on that list. So it is all over the place, and there's no rhyme or reason to it. I just kind of pick up random stuff, and it'll depend on the mood I'm in and what I'm after and what I'm trying to get. For example, this summer I went through, or really for the last year, I've been on this binge of books about creativity and the creative process. And so I'll really hone in on that and read, you know, 20 books on creativity kind of in a row, because it's just easier that way. And then I'll do something totally different. So what am I reading right now? I've read this book probably four or five times, but I read it pretty much every summer when it's nice out, which is Thoreau's journal.
Sure.
Everyone knows Thoreau's Walden, but his journal, I think, is the best thing that he produced. And it's great when you can go out and walk in the woods or whatever. So I'm rereading that right now. The last book I read was a book called A Short History of Myth. I mentioned I really like mythology. And then I actually don't know what's next. A buddy of mine, who's in the Special Forces, who's a Green Beret, I recommended a book about General Patton. And I really like World War II history, so maybe I'll read that next.
Nice. Any guilty pleasures? You know, are the Lee Child books slipping in there, an occasional John Grisham novel, or do you simply not have the time for that?
Not that I don't have the time. I'm a big believer that there's no such thing as a guilty pleasure. If you're getting pleasure out of reading, that's all that matters. It doesn't matter what it is. What I love about reading is that it's sort of a way to temporarily suspend ego and kind of get lost in something. It's very meditative, I think. And some of the most meditative books are those kind of books. For me, it was always Michael Crichton books.
Yeah.
I loved Michael Crichton growing up. I've read everything that he's written. I don't have an author like that today that I like nearly as much. I've heard Lee Child entertaining, but is he the Jack Reacher guy?
He is. And yeah, but officially, for the record, that's not my opinion, although I do have friends that have endorsed it. I didn't care for it.
Yeah, so I read the first one, and you know, I think I read it on the beach, and I think it was entertaining or whatever, but I didn't keep going. So no guilty pleasures in the traditional sense, or in the, what you might think of as the definition, but I don't really believe in that concept.
Good. Well, before I let you go this afternoon, how about this? Give me three all-time books for anybody and everybody, not just for an investor. Put you on the spot a little bit. And then give the investing audience a piece of advice or two.
Sure. Let's see. Three all-time books for anyone and everyone. So just to stick with this mythology theme, it's hard to choose one book, but there's an author named Joseph Campbell.
Yep.
Who is phenomenal. His most famous book is a book called A Hero with 1,000 Faces. And the reason it's so famous is because George Lucas credits that book as giving him the structure for the Star Wars story. And what the book does is chronicle sort of the exact same cycle that every story goes through in myths around the world. And it's remarkably similar how the mythology of different cultures and different times kind of all follows the same pattern. And that myth is really just reflective of the human condition and the things we struggle with and kind of how to live a better life. And so all of his books, I mean, are just phenomenal. Hero with 1,000 Faces or Myths to Live By would probably be the two that I recommend most wholeheartedly. The second book, I'm just going through my trusty Evernote here to try to find.
Yeah, good.
which ones I like best. And I go by which ones have I highlighted the most. So there's a book called The Tiger, A True Story of Vengeance and Survival, about a man-eating man attacking and man-eating tiger in the Russian taiga. And the author, his name's John Valent, I think is how you pronounce his last name, is one of the best writers that I've ever come across. Almost like a poetry type writing in prose form. And the story is unbelievably compelling. There's a ton in there about human nature that I think is even valuable for investors. And it's just a story that you will not be able to put that book down. It's hard to believe that it really happened. I think the story itself happened in the 90s. So it's something that actually happened pretty recently. That's kind of shocking that the world doesn't know happened, because it's such a crazy and compelling story. That's a second one. And then the last one is, I guess, a book of philosophy would be the best way to categorize it. I still don't know how to pronounce this, but it's the Upanishads or Upanishads, which is sort of the foundational, religious text of very early Hindu society. Basically, the authors of the Upanishads were forest sages, and they wrote these little stories. And the stories were, again, reflective of larger truths. And I think that is the most amazing spiritual text ever written. They're really entertaining. They're short. You can read them in short bursts. And some of them are, 6,000-8,000 years old, which is just really hard to believe that there was so much wisdom so long ago. But those three would be three that I would definitely put in that category of bulletproof, that everyone I've recommended to read those books really enjoyed them, with all kind of the same theme of trying to better understand yourself.
Great. I love it. I love it.
And as far as investing advice goes, let's see. I think for those, the active passive thing is getting a little boring to me, because it's starting to feel like a religious argument that you're not going to convince anyone of. Maybe I'll go super narrow, since it's the area that I do all my research. If you are interested in factor investing, I would highly encourage you to look at this whole idea of capital allocation as a factor very closely, because I think it's a really compelling one that's a little bit different than just value and momentum, which are probably the two most popular ones, and try to learn a little bit more about that. So looking at what companies do with their money, whether they're growing their CapEx or they're acquiring like crazy, we call those empire builders. That's a strategy that's probably fun for the managers, but doesn't always turn out so great for the shareholders. Look at companies that are buying back aggressive amounts of their shares. I wrote recently about high conviction buyback programs, buybacks is like this, talk about saturation. Like, that topic has become so huge and widespread. It's even like a campaign topic for Hillary Clinton, right. which is nuts.
Quarterly capitalism.
Yeah. Talking about, an SEC law from 1982 is pretty crazy talking point for a political campaign. So high conviction buyback programs, ones, say, companies that are buying back 10 or 15% of their shares, is a very, very different story from a company buying back 2% of its shares. And the results of those companies in the future, something that's exploitable, or at least has been exploitable historically, are pretty remarkable. And I think that gets lost, because the majority of the raw dollars being spent on buybacks is coming from those lower conviction firms. So about 70% of the actual cash going to buybacks that everyone's criticizing or worried about is coming from low conviction buyback programs, somewhere between 0 and 5% of total shares, with the remaining 30% in those high conviction buyback programs. So there's a lot of nuance there to how companies are allocating their capital. If you liked that book, The Outsiders, which was great, I think there's a way to put that into practice in investing, especially in the U.S. market. So I would encourage investors interested in factor investing to look beyond value and momentum a little bit and consider something like capital allocation.
All right. Well, Patrick, it's been a pleasure having you. I appreciate you taking some time to join us today. And we'll have links up to all the books that we talked about and Patrick's blog, obviously, up on the website. But thanks for being part of Fireside Markets.
This has been great. Thanks a lot, James.
For additional information, details regarding references made in today's episode, or to subscribe or comment on this podcast, visit us online at basinasset.com.